Conditions are driving more air pollution into the United States. Higher temperatures and reduced precipitation are causing lakes such as Utah's Great Salt Lake and California's Salton Sea to evaporate, exposing sediments to wind erosion. Between 1990s and 2000s, the number of large dust storms increased by 240% in the United States. And the climate trends have fueled explosive fire behavior. Wildfires are the front line of climate change impact on air quality, says Paul Billings, National Senior Vice President for Public Policy at the American Lung Association in Washington, D.C., adding, "We are seeing more hazardous, very unhealthy air days than we have seen in 20-plus years of doing the State of the Air report," he says. Researchers say laws intended to combat air pollution don't address increasingly important sources, such as wildfires and dust. In fact, the EPA created an exemption for the increased air pollution that occurs during wildfires, dust storms, and similar events considered to be natural. The agency's exceptional events rule, adopted in 2007, excludes days when such events happen from consideration by regulators. Since late rule came into force, Arizona's Maricopa County, home to the city of Phoenix, has used the exceptional events rule to significantly reduce the number of days the county failed to keep below pollution limits, 4 PM10. Particles below 10 micrometers in diameter. During 2011, for example, Maricopa County applied 20 exceptions for exceeding PM10 levels, 8 of which were in July alone. By pruning outliers deemed natural exceptions, the regulatory data set is skewed, says Katie Clifford, author of a paper this year that called the practice into question. The problem is how we are using the Clean Air Act, she says. It is built to respond to air quality issues caused by rule violations. So removing data reduces regulatory oversight, adds Clifford, a human geographer at the University of Colorado Boulder.
Midstream.
China is seeking to increase its influence in the Arab world, in particular with Saudi Arabia at a summit this month. There has been no announcement about which countries will attend the event, and Beijing has not yet confirmed if President Xi Jinping will be present. This Chinese caution indicates a fear of failure that might be caused by the possibility of the Saudis retreating from taking the path under American threats or temptations. Since for now, it seems that the Saudi policy towards China is somewhat made in America, meaning it is determined by the degree of bin Salman's alienation from the Biden administration. Nevertheless, Beijing will not miss a serious opportunity to fill in the U.S.'s position, or at least compete with it in a region that sits on a huge amount of global oil reserves and imports huge quantities of Chinese products. It is an opportunity that first appeared when the United States decided to reduce its presence in the Middle East to divert its efforts against Beijing to East Asia, according to the policy drawn up by American strategists during the presidency of Barack Obama. That approach was seen by the Saudis as a great threat, especially since back then it was followed by silence about the arrival of the Muslim Brotherhood to power in Egypt and Tunisia, and the nuclear deal with Iran that was negotiated behind Riyadh's back, according to Saudis. What China is not reassured about is the deception that it could be exposed to from Persian Gulf Arab regimes that are confused about how to guarantee their future at a moment of historic buoyancy as a result of global transformations that no one knows how they will end, especially after the Ukraine war. Nonetheless, the Ukraine war has benefited those Arab regimes by helping increase oil prices and allowing those regimes to establish a circumstantial alliance with Russia and basically blackmail the Americans. However, China's concerns are valid. For example, Beijing was until recently participating in the construction of a dual-purpose naval facility, both for civil and military purposes, in Abu Dhabi. But the construction stopped after serious objection from the United States towards the Emiratis. There's no doubt that the United States of America closely monitors China's moves in West Asia and specifically monitors the behavior of the Persian Gulf Arab states towards Beijing. As the Americans do this, their goal is not specifically to hit the commercial partnership between the Arabian Peninsula and China, which amounts to several hundred billion dollars annually. Rather, the Americans definitely monitor Persian Gulf countries crossing certain red lines, which the U.S. deems the borderline between strife and animosity, like aiming for strategic and military partnership with Beijing. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman. For the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman to invite the Chinese President Xi Jinping to attend three summits with Saudi Arabia, the Persian Gulf states, and the Arab countries depicts a new direct challenge to the Americans, for whom the kingdom has never hosted such summits except for U.S. administration's sake. Hence, changing the identity of the guest of honor sends a message that the Saudis are ready to replace the USA with China as a new ally if the United States continues its policy of abandoning Saudi Arabia. To discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Mr. Mataz Wahwah, political commentator. Thank you very much, Mataz, for being with us. Now, everyone's monitoring the upcoming Arab-Chinese summit that's going to take place in the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in the first 10 days of December, supposedly next week. And they are all looking to see if President Xi Jinping will be attending. But what message is Riyadh sending to the United States of America with such a new rapprochement with China?
Well, assuming that President Jinping attends the summit in Riyadh, the welcoming is supposed to be one that we haven't seen since Donald Trump's visit to Riyadh. And I think the message is very clear from Riyadh, and especially from MBS, that Saudi Arabia does have other options. They can go looking elsewhere, and they can go strengthening alliances and taking up trade deals and even arms and manufacturing deals with the United States' rival in the world, on the world scale. And I think that this is something that Mohammed bin Salman will be pushing for. This is the type of message that he will be driving with such a summit, especially considering the fact that other Arab leaders will be attending the summit, leaders that have been invited by Mohammed bin Salman.
Well, there's a lot of speculation as to the possibility of the Chinese president actually making it. Why do you think there's a speculation, or maybe this is just what the mainstream media is trying to portray, that he might do the trip?
Yeah, well, I think the speculation is aimed at keeping the United States on its toes. I think right now Saudi Arabia does not want to show all of its cards at the moment. It is locked in a sort of, I wouldn't say a cold war, but a sort of a cold face-off between, it's a game of poker between Saudi Arabia and the United States. And I think they want to see if the United States will call its bluff. Is it a bluff at all? Who will fold their cards first? This is the sort of game that Mohammed bin Salman is currently playing with the U.S.
Well, this is why we're hearing a lot of analysts saying that this Saudi policy is basically made in USA, meaning that it is determined by the degree of alienation of Mohammed bin Salman from the Biden administration and their attacks against him, especially in the media. But can a country like China, which is slowly and carefully crawling to wrest global leadership from the United States of America, base its strategies on the impulsive policy of someone like Mohammed bin Salman?
Well, I think now we see that China is sort of filling in this void that the United States has been leaving in parts of the world. We saw such moves in Africa, for example, China coming in and filling in this economic gap. When we say that this sort of a move is made in the United States, I think we should look closely at what's going on in the Ukraine at the moment. What's happened with the U.S. in the Ukraine has given a sharp and a very loud message to the United States' allies that we are not an ally that you can depend on. We are not someone that you can rely on in your times of need. And this has pushed the United States' allies to look elsewhere. And I think that when we say that such a policy is made in the United States, it's sort of unintentional.
Sort of unintentional, but at the same time, it is driving the richest country in West Asia away from the lap of the United States. Don't you think that the U.S. might hit hard someplace else?
Well, yeah, absolutely. The United States is not used to hearing the word no. However, as we said, the world is watching. The world's been watching Ukraine very closely, and they've seen that, look, we cannot rely on you. We've seen you abandon a European nation, the same color as you, the same religion as you, the same morals and standings as you. So us being an Arab nation who, yes, is tied to you politically and economically, we need to start looking at other options. We saw that the US, at the very slightest disagreement between them and the Saudi regime, they began threatening with arms embargoes and sanctions and whatnot. And this is not the way that one will treat their allies. So I think Saudi Arabia and many other allies will soon follow the suit of Saudi Arabia and begin to look towards China and alternative partners in the world.
What's interesting to monitor, Matez, is that China is not the USA, and it cannot be bought the way that Saudi Arabia used to pay a lot of money to try and buy certain policies from the U.S. For example, China does have its own interests in the region of West Asia, especially with the Saudi regime, but it is also very keen on maintaining and strengthening its alliance and its partnership with Iran, for example, which is considered as China's prime ally against the Americans to begin with, and it is also one of its strategic partners in the Silk Road map that China's trying to draw in that specific area. Is it possible to juggle both interests in a volatile region like West Asia? I mean, we all know the hostility that the Saudi regime has for the Islamic Republic.
Well, you said it. China is not the United States. And when we say that China cannot be bought, and China is very firm on its standings, on its morals. It has very firm red lines that it draws in the sand. And when it comes to allies, the Chinese, if you want to call the Chinese government or the Chinese regime, has very rarely or maybe even not known to be one that abandons their allies for trade deals and whatnot. What we can hope to see, and especially in this upcoming summit, and given the fact that, as we said, this summit won't just be held in Riyadh for Riyadh, there will be other Arab leaders there. What we can hope to see is that maybe Beijing, as we've seen in the past, can maybe be seen as an intermediary or a bridge between Saudi Arabia and the Islamic Republic of Iran, and between other Arab countries and the Islamic Republic of Iran. We have seen in the past where China will come in and mediate between two allies that happen to be rivals, and they've come to great successes in this.
Do you think that they might have a hand in maybe bringing together the Yemenis and the Saudis to the table?
Well, we'd sure hope so. As you said, China has a vested interest in maintaining peace in the region. This is number one. And number two, it has a vested interest in giving priority to its number one ally in the region, which is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Mm-hmm. So we can definitely at least hope that China can bring the Saudis and the Yemenis to the table. And this will be a further blow to the United States.
Well, changes are away and fast in the region of West Asia, especially since just 4 years ago, or even less than that, we were watching Donald Trump dancing with Saudi royals, and now is China basically invading the U.S. territory. I want to thank you very much, Mohtaz Wahwah, political commentator, for joining us to talk about this very crucial and new matter to West Asia. But please stay tuned, because next we want to see how the World Cup of Qatar is supporting none other than Palestine.
This is Midstream, and here is IRIB English Radio. Dear listeners, in this weekly program, Marvo Osman discusses two important issues related to West Asia region with two political analysts. Midstream is with you every Friday on IRIB English Radio.
During the past few days, the campaign of solidarity and wide sympathy with the Palestinian cause was remarkable on the sidelines of the FIFA World Cup organized by Qatar. Chanting for freedom for Palestine and raising Palestinian flags has become a scene that almost all stadiums, streets, and mass gatherings are devoid of. Perhaps this matter came as a surprise to some who believed that the Palestinian cause had lost its luster and had become one of the marginal issues for a large segment of Arabs and Muslims. World Cup fans support Palestine in this following report.
It has always been the norm for all those who are keen on supporting the Palestinian cause to open broad and comprehensive horizons for dialogue and communication with peoples and masses far from regimes and governments, to push everything that would support Palestine against the British-installed and American-protected Zionist occupation of the Arab land of Palestine. Yet Western mainstream media completely blacks out any news that comes from Palestine or in support of Palestine, and social media platforms follow suit, banning pro-Palestinian pages and accounts. But the FIFA World Cup 2022 in Qatar has been a surprise so far. During the 48th minute of the Tunisia-Australia match at the World Cup in Qatar last Saturday, Tunisian fans held up a huge flag bearing the words "Free Palestine." Moroccan fans did the same the next day during their team's game against Belgium. For Arabs and Palestinians, 48 is a key number in the memory of their national catastrophe. It refers to 1948, the year of the Nakba, when their grandparents were killed and expelled from their homeland to create a new colony for Britain called Israel. Arabs and pro-Palestinian supporters worldwide use this number to express their love and support for Palestinians. The displays of Palestinian banners by Tunisian and Moroccan fans came as Israeli TV presenters complained that Arab fans have not welcomed them at the football tournament in Qatar. Numerous videos have shown Arab fans refusing to talk to Israeli channels and expressing their support for Palestinians. Today, the World Cup in Qatar is providing an open source for Arab peoples to express their disapproval of their regime's act of normalization with the Zionist Israeli entity. However, is that enough? Is Qatar really allowing such kind of solidarity with the aim of bringing change to the official Arab regime's treachery towards the Palestinian cause? Indeed, beyond feelings of solidarity towards Palestinians, the close public alliance between Israeli politicians and corrupt Arab dictators has increased hostility towards the Zionist entity among Arab publics. But what has it done to stop the constant Israeli bombardment of Gaza, or the constant killing and incarceration of Palestinian natives in the streets of occupied Al-Quds and the West Bank? Resolving major issues does not only need campaigns of solidarity and sympathy, despite their importance. Victory over an enemy armed to its teeth does not come through campaigns and hashtags, despite their impact. Rather, Palestine needs real and sustainable action through an integrated system in which all parties participate. Any solidarity that does not reflect effectively and decisively in support of the Palestinian cause and the Palestinian people on the ground, whether on the material level, moral level, and most importantly, the military and armament level, is a solidarity that has no real benefit within it.
Now to discuss this issue with us from Beirut is Saleh Abu Aize, a regular political commentator from the West Bank on a visit to Lebanon. It's an honor to have you with us here, Mr. Abu Aize. Now, Saleh, it was significant during the past weeks to see the broad campaign of solidarity with Palestine on the sidelines of the FIFA World Cup in the state of Qatar. Yet during the same time, we saw the Al-Quds double operation happening. We saw the killing of a Palestinian native by a Zionist colonial settler from point blank happening also in occupied Palestine. And we also saw Israel bombing Gaza again. This all happened during the World Cup. So how effective was the World Cup solidarity campaign in shining light on those particular events?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the most gracious, the most merciful. First of all, there is no doubt that the World Cup in Qatar has proven that the Arab and Islamic peoples, and even the free peoples of the world as a whole, are on one side, and the normalized regimes that do not support the Palestinian cause are in another side. We have seen the great popular interaction with the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause, and this confirms the affiliation of the Arab and Islamic nation and the free peoples of the world towards the central cause of the Arab and Islamic world, which is the Palestinian cause. There is no doubt that this World Cup has a very important message. It is a global meeting in which all the peoples of the world, from all walks of life, religions and races, gather to affirm that the Palestinian cause is in the conscience of the nations and the conscience of the world. This is necessary for the Palestinian people. This is from one side. On the other hand, it also confirms that the Palestinian struggle continues. Since this world and the peoples of the world believe in the injustice against the Palestinian people, and believe in the terrorism of the Israeli entity, it is very natural that the basic duty that the Palestinians perform is self-defense, first. And self-defense can only be attained through resistance. This resistance is a strategic choice for our Palestinian people and for everyone who stands by the Palestinian people. However, it must always be pointed out that it is unacceptable for the Palestinian people to support and sympathize with them, but not to support the resistance or to describe this resistance as terrorism or criminality, or to portray the victim in the position of the executioner. There is an Israeli executioner, and this has always been the Palestinian narrative. There is an Israeli executioner and a Palestinian victim. Hence, we saw what happened with Palestinian Mara Ammar in the Hawara region last week in occupied Palestine. This is what the world's cameras saw. This is what was monitored. In the sense that the Israeli occupation since before the Zionist gangs in 1948 and the establishment of this entity, it has been committing these crimes against the Palestinian people. However, the cameras did not capture many of these crimes. This crime appeared to the public in this way because there was a camera that documented the field execution that was practiced against Ammar, just as the thousands of individuals from our Palestinian people who perished the same way.
Well, Mr. Saleh, Palestine is still considered by many to be the central cause of the Arab and Islamic nation, as you referred just now. That was never a doubt, by the way. But yet, is it enough to promote campaigns and launch hashtags on social media, even though at a global event like that of the World Cup? I mean, what can an incarcerated Palestinian native do with a hashtag when he's in solitary confinement, and or a Palestinian in Gaza who is living under Israeli bombs? What can they benefit from a hashtag?
As we always say, all forms of Palestinian resistance must be on the table and be practiced against the Israeli occupation. Whether peaceful resistance, military resistance, media resistance, and all forms of other types of resistance. Even in military resistance, there must be popular resistance, individual resistance, and organized resistance. All of this is required in the Palestinian arena. And since this resistance in this way is required, therefore, the Arab and Islamic world and the free people of the world must also show all forms of solidarity with the Palestinian people and with the resistance of the Palestinian people. So yes, it is true that these media campaigns and media efforts are required to support the Palestinian cause and to expose the Israeli entity and publicize its terrorism and crimes leading to perhaps its trial. But the question always remains, is that enough? I think this is not enough. just as Palestine needs a loud voice that shows the injustice being done to the Palestinian cause, it also needs the bullet that supports its resistance in order to defend our Palestinian people. These are the foundations of the conflict with the Israeli occupation, and the foundations of the issue in dealing with the Arab and Islamic depth. Therefore, our Palestinian people always talk about their lack of Arab and Islamic depth. Why? Because whoever truly supports the Palestinian resistance and he who is entrusted with defending the Palestinian people and the Palestinian cause and repelling the aggressions of the Israeli occupation is the axis of resistance only, under the leadership of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Iran is the one that strengthens this line, this current, this path, and this alliance with its states and parties. Iran is the one that supports the right to support the Palestinian resistance because it stands by all forms of Palestinian struggle. It stands by us in the media, financially, militarily, security-wise, and politically. Now, some Arabs, some countries, and some free people of this world do support Palestine in the media, but without the financial, military, and political support. So with all certainty, their support will remain incomplete.
Well, in less than 1 minute, Mr. Saleh, we did see how Israel felt very disappointed with what happened to its correspondents and how its colonial settlers were treated in Qatar. But will that change the Arab-Israeli normalization process that thus far has promoted the Arab regimes with zero benefits?
There was an Israeli proposal in the past, the content of which was land in exchange for peace, then the security in exchange for peace, until we reached the proposal that the Israeli wanted, which is peace in exchange for peace. However, it is true that Israel wants the peace from the Arab and Islamic regimes because they benefit from it economically, militarily, and politically. But at the same time, Israel wants popular normalization with the Arab countries and the peoples of the Arab countries. Because the entity still feels with all its factions, its government and its settlers, all of them feel that they are a foreign entity to this region in terms of language, religion, culture and even morals. So this strange feeling of this entity, that it wants to discover what the normalization agreements have accomplished, in the sense that it is only the Abraham Accords we are talking about, but Camp David up to Wadi Araba, the Oslo Accords and ending with the Abraham Accords. Especially since there is a prelude to more Arab countries that will join the train of normalization, led by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Despite Netanyahu's recent statement that Saudi Arabia is the head of the normalizers and the protector of this project. However, until this moment, it has not yet entered into the establishment of diplomatic relations with the occupying entity, for issues related to feeling the public pulse and so on. So the presence of the Israelis in Qatar, which is definitely condemned, their presence is, yes, a kind of feeling the pulse for the Arab street. To know where did these agreements reach and what should be done at the level of media, politics and cultural programs to reach an advanced stage of normalization.
Well, I think that they did get their answer when everyone refused to talk to them and everyone refused to even say hello to them and everyone kept saying freedom to Palestine, and indeed that freedom will come on. Well, thank you very much, Saleh Abu Azzeh, political commentator from the West Bank, joining us here in Beirut. Thank you for your contribution, and I want to thank you. I hope you continue supporting Palestine, the central cause for all Muslims, all Arabs, and all free people of the world. I'll see you again next week. Assalamu alaikum.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
During years of occupation, Israeli military forces have deliberately killed several Palestinian journalists to prevent reporting of their crimes against oppressed Palestinians. One of these journalists was Al Jazeera's correspondent Shirin Abu Akleh, who was brutally assassinated by the Zionists. Palestinian officials and the family of Abu Akleh have said they believe she was assassinated deliberately by Israeli regime forces and have submitted an official complaint to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, at The Hague in Netherlands to demand justice. We have taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. Al Jazeera television network has filed a formal request to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, against Israeli regime forces over the assassination of the veteran Palestinian-American journalist Shirin Abu Akleh, saying it has new evidence showing she was murdered by Israeli military. The Qatar-based network said in a statement on Tuesday, 6th of December, that its legal team has conducted a full and detailed investigation into the case and has unearthed new evidence based on several eyewitness accounts and video footage that clearly shows Abu Akleh and her colleagues were directly fired at in a deliberate killing by Israeli military forces. The statement went on to say that the claim by Israeli authorities that a Palestinian journalist was assassinated by mistake in an exchange of fire is completely unfounded. The statement added, the evidence presented to the Office of the Prosecutor confirms without any doubt that there was no firing in the area where Abu Akleh was, other than Israeli forces shooting directly at her. The statement said, the evidence shows that this deliberate killing was part of a wider campaign to target and silence Al Jazeera network. The network also said, Al Jazeera reiterates its commitment to achieving justice for Shirin Abu Akleh and to exploring all avenues to ensure that the perpetrators are held accountable and brought to justice. Rodney Dixon, a lawyer for Al Jazeera, called on the International Criminal Court, the ICC, to identify those who were directly involved in Abu Akleh's assassination and to bring charges against them. Rodney Dixon said, we're making a request for an investigation that leads to charges being brought and those responsible being prosecuted. Shirin Abu Akleh was shot in the head and murdered by Israeli army on 11th of May while she was covering the raid in the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. At the time of her assassination, the 51-year-old Palestinian journalist was wearing easily recognizable press attire. Multiple investigations by independent organizations and media outlets have already concluded that Abu Akleh was deliberately shot by the Israeli military. Following long denial, the Israeli military finally admitted in September that Abu Akleh might have accidentally been killed by Israeli fire directed towards suspects identified as Palestinian resistance fighters. Numerous witnesses and inquiries into the incident have also disputed the Zionist regime's claim, saying there were no Palestinian fighters around when the murder took place. Meanwhile, the Tehran-based Kayhan International has also covered the same story. Al Jazeera spent 6 months investigating the incident and gathering eyewitness statements and accounts, video footage and other material to hand over to the International Criminal Court at The Hague. None of it has been made public. Recently, Al Jazeera aired a documentary that showed how Abu Akleh and other journalists wearing protective helmets and bulletproof vests marked with the word press came under fire. The network's request follows a complaint submitted to the International Criminal Court, the ICC, by Shirin Abu Aqila's family in September, together with the Palestinian Press Syndicate and the International Federation of Journalists, the IFJ. The International Criminal Court, the ICC, decided in 2021 that it has jurisdiction over occupied West Bank. An investigation by the non-governmental organization Forensic Architecture and the Ramallah-based human rights organization Al-Haq in September found that Abu Aqila and her colleagues were explicitly targeted despite being identifiable as members of the press. According to their investigation, the source of the gunfire that martyred Shirin Abu Aqila was a Zionist army marksman in an armored vehicle. Contrary to statements by the occupying Israeli regime that said Abu Aqila was killed during a battle between Palestinian gunmen and Israeli soldiers, the organizations also found that there were no shots fired from Palestinian fighters and no armed Palestinians present in the area in the moments leading up to Abu Aqila's killing. The investigators found once she was shot, the Israeli marksman continued to shoot at those trying to help Abu Aqila, deliberately preventing her from receiving medical treatment. The FBI opened a probe into the assassination of Shirin Abu Aqila last month. In response, the Israeli War Minister Benny Gantz said on Twitter, "Israel will not cooperate with the FBI investigation, calling the investigation a grave mistake." The White House denied any knowledge of the FBI investigation. The English website of the Al Jazeera television network has also covered the same story. The United States has voiced opposition to Al Jazeera's push to ensure accountability at the International Criminal Court, the ICC, for the assassination of journalist Shirin Abu Aqila, who was shot by Israeli military in the occupied West Bank earlier this year. Hours after the network submitted a request to the Hague-based International Criminal Court on Tuesday, 6th of December, to investigate and prosecute those responsible for the assassination of the Palestinian-American journalist, the U.S. State Department said it rejects the move. State Department spokesperson Ned Price told reporters, "We oppose it in this case." Washington has long stood against Palestinian-led efforts to take up Israeli abuses with international bodies, including the United Nations and the International Criminal Court, the ICC. When asked about Al Jazeera's request to the court, Ned Price said, "We maintain our long-standing objections to the ICC's investigation into the Palestinian situation. The ICC should focus on its core mission, and that core mission is of serving as a court of last resort in punishing and deterring atrocity crimes." Shirin Abu Aqila's assassination spurred worldwide condemnation and demands for justice. The Israeli regime, which human rights groups charge with imposing a system of apartheid on the Palestinians, receives $3.8 billion in U.S. security assistance every year. On Tuesday, State Department spokesman Ned Price reiterated a U.S. call for accountability in the case. He noted, "We said consistently that this needs to be investigated and that ultimately it needs to culminate in accountability. We continue to have conversations with our Israeli counterparts about the importance of accountability." But when pressed about opposition to the International Criminal Court's involvement in the case, given that Israeli authorities have ruled out a criminal investigation into the assassination of the Palestinian-American journalist, Ned Price said, "Accountability in this context relates to general procedures by the Israeli military to ensure protections for non-combatants." In September, after the Israeli military admitted that one of its soldiers murdered Shirin Abu Aqila, Washington scaled back its calls for accountability, urging instead an Israeli review of its military rules of engagement to mitigate civilian harm, a demand that was explicitly rejected by the Israeli leadership. Previously, the Biden administration had rejected calls for an independent investigation into the assassination, insisting that Israel is able to investigate allegations of misconduct by its military forces. Numerous U.S. legislators, including some staunch Israeli supporters, had called on Washington to launch its own investigation into the case. Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
For a couple of months now, street protests, riots and vandalism have been going on in Iran. It is an odd situation in that few segments of the society, with their own self-interested scores to settle against the Islamic Republic of Iran, have basically joined online to create a virtual environment where, to the simple-minded, it would appear that the Islamic Republic is in serious trouble. The truth, to put it rather mildly, is way off the mark. It is uncertain what has become of the unrest yet, but the Western press has spun a narrative that the majority in Iran is against the government, and that's not true, according to independent international journalists. Aside from the riots and street vandalism, there is a legitimate protest, all right. For the most part, a section of the urban middle class and a large section of the upper class are protesting against some social issues related to the morality police and government inactions. This includes men and women. However, to believe that they form the majority is to let the imagination run wild. In total numbers, they form a small minority of the Iranian 87 million strong population. For an analysis of the current state of the unrest in Iran, stay with us on this edition of Iran Today. Despite the extreme efforts by the anti-Iranian media and writers to convince the world that the protests are widespread and the country is crippled, the majority of people lead their normal lives and the fake and real dissent mostly show up in virtual networks.
Cognitive warfare is successful when it uses mass media and social media. It needs to involve celebrities and separatists and move towards civil uprising to hinder democratic processes. It appears that we have been facing a cognitive warfare campaign in social media. It brought different layers of economic, social, and political elements to the fore in order to advance its purpose, which was to cripple the democratic processes in Iran.
In Tehran, with a population of around 9 million in the city and 15 million in the larger metropolitan area of Greater Tehran, even if one person turns out for protests, it will constitute a sizable number. But their percentage remains just that, approximately 1%. As such, a revolution will remain a distant possibility without the presence of a critical mass.
In relation to what's actually taking place right now in the country, we hear different analyses about it. It has a few definite components. One is the fact that, after all, there are some demands by the society, even if it wasn't expressed in appropriate ways. But these demands had to come to the surface, and in every democratic society, this process is ongoing and routine. Naturally, the establishment needs to be responsive to these demands as long as they are within the law and have not crossed the defined boundaries of the country.
Furthermore, an aspect that observers with vested interest tend to miss is that pro-government rallies in Iran are substantially larger than the anti-establishment rallies, which substantiates the argument by socio-political experts that the majority still believes in the Islamic Republic. But since the news of the unrest reaches the global audience after getting manipulated by the Western press, the truth becomes the casualty.
We've been forced into a dirty war imposed by our enemies in the recent unrest. This still passed, but America's enmity towards us is endless. It seems like, other than the disintegration of the Islamic Republic of Iran, or giving them ransom, Americans won't be satisfied with anything else. They're using their media full force to bring us down to our knees, because they're afraid of our strength and progress. Yes, this will pass, and we'll not lose this battle either.
Iranian officials believe that maybe if the Islamic Republic, like some other countries, such as New Zealand, had a secret way to censor famous virtual networks like Facebook and Twitter, the recent unrest would have ended sooner. In March 2010, New Zealand Department of Internal Affairs stated that such a filter was operational and in use. Tech Liberty NZ, the New Zealand organization defending civil liberties in the digital age, objected to the launch of the filter, but DIA defended the system and noted that trials over 2 years showed that the filter did not affect the speed or stability of the internet for end users.
In normal situations, if you take your camera around the city, in front of the parliament or some ministry buildings or social security offices, there isn't a week that goes by without seeing some groups making their case and have some demands. Of course, they get permission before doing so. This is for real. I'm sure many times your cameras have captured footage of it. But suddenly we see a process that starts in some way and ends up differently. The enemy is after picking his fruit. What is the process? It's a scenario in which hatred towards the government is blown over by spreading lies and untruths in order to impact people's minds. For instance, they convey to people that whatever freedom you have, which might be even greater than that of Western societies, is not actually freedom, and try to convince you of that.
In the recent unrest in Iran, those people who have been protesting democratically, according to some local politicians, might have even managed to extract some concessions from the establishment. However, the protests have often been marred by another group. This particular group also comes more or less from the same social background, but have grown up on a sustained diet of anti-Islamic Republic TV channels hosted by an excessive number of groups, including the US, the UK, and Saudi Arabia, but also MKO terrorist cult and the monarchists. It is this group that penetrates most of the protests and turns them into a riot that then turns into a cycle of violence. We must remember that many of the folks killed in the violence in the last couple of months are security personnel. If so many security or police personnel had died during a protest in any Western country, especially in the US, the protesters would have been crushed with the most brutal force.
Western media outlets exert their influence based on spreading lies, deception, disinformation, and writing fake death stories. But our security police force went to work based on the plan to calm the situation as peacefully as possible. And this is what happened. We saw that security and police forces approached the crowd without weapons. This is unique in police history. That is why you see the prime ministers of England and Canada order reckless crowd control methods towards the recent demonstrations in their countries.
Then there are CIA and Mossad-supported separatist groups, right from Baluch-dominated Jaish al-Adl in southeastern Iran to CIA-trained Kurdish groups who find sanctuary in Iraqi Kurdistan. These groups have used the opportunity to mount terrorist attacks as the Iranian security apparatus gets distracted by the planned protests and riots. The horrifying memories of a similar terrorist attack last month by Daesh operatives at the Shah-e-Cheragh shrine in Shiraz are still very fresh in the minds of most Iranians and terror victims.
You are not letting people express their desire. For instance, the Sanandaj merchant who says, I spontaneously got in that situation when President Raisi was visiting Sanandaj Bazaar.
He says, I offered some chocolate as an ordinary act of kindness, not anything political, but it was interpreted viciously by those who have been creating hatred and havoc in Kurdistan. They subjected him to threats and harm. Well, what happened to this merchant is a small act of dictatorship itself. And is this an example of how you want to run the country? So this example reveals what these enemies are about and also those who are leading them from outside of our borders.
In the last few days alone, at least three commanders of the terrorist groups opposed to the Islamic Republic, namely Kako Aliyar, a central committee member of the Komala Kurdish separatist group, Mima Mohammadi, a senior Peshmerga commander, and an unnamed commander of Baluch Jaish al-Ad group, have released video messages admitting how they have coordinated with and facilitated rioters and terrorists inside Iran in planning and executing these violent attacks that killed several members of the Iranian security apparatus.
Predictions based on the scenarios that Western think tanks are writing and planning or that they are after extending and stretching this environment in hopes that either this situation will push the Islamic Republic to compromise on its stance or, in their perception, collapse and be disintegrated. However, the truth of the matter is that in terms of security, the country is fully secured, but naturally, we can expect to see some flare-ups here and there. Of course, the axis of this animosity is clearly the US, its European allies, the Zionist regime, and the regional mercenaries.
These messages indicate that in many ways, the playbook appears to be a repeat of Syria and Libya. A small but violent group is propped up by the Western intelligence agencies through their original assets, and the protests, which start as legitimate, are then rapidly turned into a fertile environment for these violent groups. There is plenty more, right after a quick diversion into world media. Here is how it looks on the page. Al Jazeera reads, Iran sentences four people to death for cooperating with Israel. Four people have been handed the death penalty by Iran's judiciary after being accused of working with intelligence services of Israel and kidnapping, according to the semi-official Mehr news agency. Referring to Israel, Mehr said on Wednesday they were sentenced to death for the crime of cooperating with intelligence services of the Zionist regime and for kidnapping. With guidance from the Zionist intelligence services, this network of thugs was stealing and destroying private and public property, kidnapping people and obtaining fake confessions. Tasnim News says, Iran to file complaint to FIFA Ethics Committee against US soccer team. The legal advisor of the Iranian Football Federation, Safiyullah Faghanpour, said the sports association will file a complaint against the U.S. soccer team with FIFA's ethics committee after the U.S. men's national soccer team disrespected the national flag of Iran. Respecting nation's flag is an accepted international practice that all other nations must emulate. The action conducted in relation to the Iranian flag is unethical and against international law, Faghanpour said. The U.S. football team breached the FIFA charter by posting a distorted image of the flag of the Islamic Republic of Iran on its official Twitter page, for which a 10-game suspension is the appropriate penalty. FIFA implemented a more stringent punishment for racist behavior in 2019, doubling the minimum suspension from 5 to 10 games, and the governing body has shown that it will drop the hammer in high-stakes games. The Guardian reads, Klinsmann to call Kayrosh and calm things down after Iran dispute. Jürgen Klinsmann has pledged to call Carlos Kayrosh in an effort to smooth things over after his contentious comments on the Iran coach and his team. After Friday's 2-0 win over Wales, the BBC presenter Gabby Logan talked about Iran's gamesmanship and said they just stayed on the right side of the law before handing over to Klinsmann. Yes, that's their culture, he said. Their way of doing it, and that is why Carlos Kayrosh fits really well with the Iranian national team. Kayrosh continued, As an American-German, we understand you are no supporter, no problem, and despite your outrageous remarks on BBC, trying to undermine our efforts, sacrifices, and skills, Kayrosh said. Kayrosh then called into question Klinsmann's official role with FIFA. At the same time, we just want to follow with full attention what will be the decision of FIFA regarding your position as a member of Qatar 2022 Technical Study Group, because obviously we expect you to resign before you visit our camp.
This is Iran Today. Iran Today is broadcast every week on Fridays and Saturdays. The series analyzes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
Meanwhile, another released video, this time of the judicial trial of men involved in the brutal killing of a young Iranian refugee, has been circulating on social media, with confessions from offenders on how they murdered Sayed Ruhollah Ajamian. He was stabbed to death by a group of riders armed with cold weapons in early November in Karaj City, the capital of central Elbourz province near Tehran. During the trial, Mohammad Mahdi Karami, one of the offenders, described how he and his accomplices killed Ajamian. He told the judge, "I heard someone say, 'There is a Besiji man out there.' I turned around and saw he had fallen to the ground and three people were surrounding him and beating him. The young man tried to run away," Karami said, "but everyone was hitting him with stones, knives, even bare hands. Their attitudes were weird," he said. The video of the trial in the Persian language showed at least a dozen young men present in the courtroom who confessed to their role in the killing of Ajamian, with some asking for forgiveness, saying they were carried away due to foreign media incitement.
"Naturally, due to our country's many adversaries, we've been involved in a hybrid war in the past few years, meaning that the enemy tries to use all of his tools, be it at street level, in cyberspace, security, and media, to complete the hybrid war puzzle. It's predicted that it will sustain the effort to ride the wave caused by the social unrest and misdirect it for its own purposes and change events to riots and such."
Meanwhile, as the campaign of false news against Islamic Republic continues, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has joined the chorus of social media trolls, spreading a flagrant untruth. When the propaganda wing of MKO in Albania floated an absolutely bogus story of 15,000 protesters being condemned to death by the Iranian Majlis, even the Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau fell for it. He used the opportunity to tweet that Canada condemns the Iranian regime's brutal decision to execute almost 15,000 protesters. He had to later delete the tweet to stop the embarrassment. Not for a second did any of his advisors stop and ponder as to why Majlis, which is a legislative body, would award death sentences and not the judiciary.
Spreading lies and false news has had many faces in the recent anti-Iran campaign. For example, on a daily basis, there was a claim that a certain person was allegedly killed by security forces, while there were other reasons leading to their death. Case in point, Nikash Shakarami, who actually fell off a building. Parsa Akbarian died of cardiac arrest at school. Negin Abdulmaliki, who was taken to hospital due to alcohol overdose on the day of her death. Atefa Naomi committed suicide at her home.
In light of the recent Western media campaign against Iran, even the Soccer World Cup wasn't left alone. Football, too, became an increasingly heated flashpoint in the last couple of weeks, with the World Cup providing the Western media outlets another global spotlight to attempt to push their agenda on the unrest inside the Islamic Republic. Iran's head coach Carlos Queiroz confronted a BBC journalist following yet another press conference dominated by questions over political issues in Iran. The head coach demanded to know why other football managers do not face similar questions on political situations. In a video shared by a BBC reporter, the head coach asked, "Why don't you ask Southgate these kinds of questions? Do you think it is fair also to ask other questions to other coaches?" he said. "That is the only question I have. Why don't you ask the other coaches? Why don't you ask Southgate what do you think about England and the United States that left Afghanistan and all the women alone? Why don't you ask that?" he added.
The World Cup seems to have been hindrance in the uprising process. Whoever wanted a disunited Iran, this was an impediment for them. The World Cup can form and boost the national identity. For this reason,